You're listening to Swimming World Radio, and today we're talking with Bob Trefine from Australia, who is a retired medical physicist working with the British team on various aspects of physiology. Thanks for joining us today, Bob.
And pleased to be with you, Brent.
Well, I understand you really got into swimming based on your background as a career as a medical physicist, where you were pioneering the radio technology for electrocardiograms. And if I understand this correctly, once the that equipment was being used, you got more fascinated with the application, how this is being used, and you got drawn into swimming. Is that correct?
That's right. I was working on a radio telemetry of ECGs where we had the attachment to the swimmers. In this is I'm talking 1974, and getting the ECGs directly onto the side of the pool, and in looking at this and wondering what kind of use we could make of it, I looked into what was currently the best work being done at that time, which was being done by Holmair in Stockholm, and so I thought I'd just see whether I could get some information similar to what they were getting in swimming flumes. And so I started off looking at efficiency of swimmers by measuring heart rate.
Now, heart rate seems to be one of the key factors in training, and you in the early pioneering stage, it becomes commonplace. But I think a lot of listeners maybe don't realize how important heart rate is and what things it can indicate in an athlete. So let's kind of dive into those things. So, you know, one of the big indicators I think a lot of coaches work off of is looking at heart rate as being an indicator of how much lactate's being produced.
Lactate's reasonably important, but the lactate picture is very difficult to read if you don't take into account a lot of the information that we have at the moment. Really important, but the lactate picture is very difficult to read if you don't take into account a lot of the information that we have at the moment, where we have a lactate transporting system, which has different transporters, like different buses or taxis. That interact with each other, and the lactate is not the blood lactate that we measure is really not the full message about what's happening with blood lactate. So you need really to understand the importance of lactate or a measure of lactate. You need to have a model of what you think is really happening within the body, and if that model doesn't include the taxi system taking the lactate from the white fast twitch fibres, where it's predominantly produced, into the red fibres, and then given the opportunity to be oxidised into a useful energy substrate, then you're not really looking at the right picture. So lactate and heart rate are kind of different issues in my mind.
Okay, well, let's approach it from a different angle then. Just on a very simplistic level, you know, when someone's heart rate gets to a very, very high level, a lot of times the heart being very fast, the amount of oxygen that's being used for the production of ATP is not enough, and they go into an anaerobic stage where lactate becomes a byproduct, and at that point in time a simple measure tells them how hard they've worked. But how that lactate is resynthesized once it's produced, either through the liver, through the glycogen process, things like that, is kind of what you were just referring to. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. The the lactate will be produced any time that the fibres, the white fibres and the fast twitch red fibres, any time that they're being used, and that lactate will sometimes be reoxidised within the system, within the muscle system, not in the whites but in the reds, and will give you the ATP that you want to kind of continue the progress. But But you can, the lactate is produced at a lower level of heart rate than the maximum heart rate, right? And so you have to realise there is an intricate kind of system going on with the lactate, and so you have to separate your thinking between high heart rates and what the lactate is. And I've looked at this I first started looking at this when I made some huge mistakes with advising coaches back in the 1970s, and I thought that I better understand what this lactate is about. And the lactate story is something that's not well, the story I have in my head, the model I have in my head is not well documented. And so it's not just a matter of looking at a blood lactate and saying, oh, it's high, therefore this athlete is working too hard or whatever. Because you have to take into account whether the lactate's under control. You can have high levels still under control, and with some athletes you can have low levels that are not under control. So you've got to kind of see the difference between this, and it all comes back to understanding the speed at which the lactate starts getting out of control with the athletes. And this speed I measure using heart rates, which I call a critical speed, and above that critical speed you start, the lactate is no longer, the lactate you're producing is no longer at a level, at a production level that the aerobic system, the oxidisation and so forth, can keep it under control.
Is it safe to say then that the everyone has a different critical level?
Yes, everyone has a different level, and that's one of the things that people should appreciate about it. And there was a very good paper published by a Chinese, Zhao Ming, way back. Zhao Ming's now a disgraced coach. He was looking after the Chinese women's sprint at one stage. But as a student, he contacted me, and I put him on a project that was interesting me, where he looked at my critical speed, and looked at swimmers' capability of swimming 1500 metres at that speed. And if you measure the lactate level for an athlete at this critical speed, and it's 5 millimoles or below, then they can virtually swim the 1500 at that critical speed. But if it's 8, they swim a little bit slower for the 1500, and if it's 15 at critical speed, they can't get anywhere near that critical speed for the 1500. And it's this information that I use a lot in differentiating the swimmer's capabilities. If you really want to understand or use lactate, you need some good model that you're working from, and I've created a model where I've started looking at the intricacies of the different transporters, the MCT4s and the MCT1s, and how they interact within the body, and the way that they kind of can transfer the lactate within the red to the red fibres and be useful. Right? So one of the main thing that you're trying to do with athletes is to buffer, but I don't like the word buffer, to utilise the lactate in a way that it's useful for the athlete. That is to kind of oxidise it, and to do this, you need specific kinds of training to optimise the result.
Well, let's touch base just briefly here on back to the red fibres and the white fibres. There was talk at some point in time that you can basically take a biopsy to find out, you know, who's predisposed to having more white fibres versus those who are red fibre. Is that a legitimate thing to do? Could you just basically look at the muscle structure, the fiber structure, to determine some of your models to be used in your model?
Well, you can do that. You can take biopsies of athletes. I wouldn't like to do that with elite athletes, but you could do that, and you could get a measure of the percentage of whites and reds. But that's kind of almost irrelevant in swimming, because you get them a trained athlete to swim 200 metres, and you very quickly find out whether they're got a lot of white fibres or a lot of reds.
You know? Okay, so you don't have to be that invasive to find out. Now, is the white fibres considered like slow twitch and red fibres fast twitch? With
the white fibres are definitely fast twitch. They're the ones that are pulled in it when you're wanting to.
Okay, so the white fibres are fast twitch.
Fast, yeah, right. And when you're born, you actually are born predominantly with slow twitch reds and fast twitch whites. But with a young kid, you know, you can get a young kid. I've got 11 grandkids, so I've got great experience with young kids running around. You can get them running up a driveway 10 or 20 times and then looking as though they're kind of in top of the world, and all of a sudden, bang-o, they want to be carried, right? Well, they want to be carried because they haven't got many reds at this stage of their life. They've got whites that have chopped up with lactate, and the lactate, unless it's trained, hasn't got a taxi system to kind of take the lactate out into the kind of interstitial fluid and then subsequently into the reds. So they just kind of seize up. And so you have this growth factor with people that exercise those white fibres a lot, where you have a transition from white fast twitch fibres to red, and so a trained athlete like these trained swimmers that I've got in front of me here in the pool, they over the years have had a large transition of those white fibres into their red fast twitch fibres and the deltoids and so forth, where they are doing most of their work, most of their fast work. And these fibres have been born, right, really, to kind of do the lactate thing better. So they produce lactate internally, but they've got an oxygen system, because they've got a capillary system built around them that enables the lactate to be not processed out into the arterial system, but to stay
the capillaries.
Yeah. But to stay within the muscle and be utilised as a food substrate, and therefore ATP. Well, because they're available, the white fibres that are near them, because these red fast twitch fibres have been born from them, so they're within that same structure. They put their hands up when the white fibres are over-generating lactate. And so as long as you've got your taxi systems working, the taxi system taking the lactate quickly out of the white fibres, which is a trained thing,
and the
MCT4s, right, and the taxi system, the MCT1s, which is sitting around in the interstitial fluid, the fluid between those fibres.
Does training build up the number of those taxi systems?
Oh, yeah.
That's the whole basis.
That's the whole basis.
Okay.
Right.
Can you measure those?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, so what I've been doing is I've been modelling these processes, and trying to put numbers into the quantity that can come out at a certain time and so on. And then looking at these, and then say designing sets where I feel that we can optimise the build-up of the MCT4s and optimise the build-up of the MCT1s. Right? And so there are different sets that I'm working, have been working with the Australians, and subsequently now I've worked with my models have kind of improved since then a little. Subsequently, working with the British.
Model based now strictly on measuring heart rate?
No, heart rate helps in understanding the speeds that I want to swim for the MCT1.
So what measures are you using to as a standard protocol that you can use as your model?
Well, heart rate, we're still using heart rate as a guide to the speeds that I want people to do to optimise the MCT1 activity. But the MCT4 activity, it's just a matter of understanding, accepting that my model is correct, and that then helps push various odd sets into different directions that I think will increase that value, because you can't measure the number of NCT4s. But what you can do, if you set up sets, you can measure your ability to swim very fast work in a large volume regularly, right? And if you can do that, then that's a measure. That's the only measure that I can get, right? Eventually, you'll find that people like Brooks, who's at Berkeley, his group, who look into the MCT1 and MCT4 activities, they might be able to set up for athletes a way of measuring the MCT4s, but there's nothing available at the moment.
So is it safe to say that the whole purpose of what you are doing is to make sure that those athletes are producing within their training enough transport systems, enough buses that's going to take whatever lactate they produce and then move it back into the red cells, red fibers, I'm sorry, to continue to produce energy? I mean, that's the whole core purpose of what you're focused on.
That's right, Brent. That over the years, this is what has kind of got me into this kind of situation where I feel that the lactate transporting system is the main thing that we're training, and so the sets that I'm recommending for the coaches are sets that will optimise the build-up of MCT1 activity and then in different sets.
I think it's important that our listeners realize that you're not limited to only the distance swimmers here. It affects all speeds, all distances, and all strokes. And for a distance person, obviously, it's very important. But for a sprinter, they can continue day in and day out training because they can sprint longer, repeat sets longer because they have built up this lactate transport system.
Yeah, no, they can't necessarily do them longer. The ability to do...
I mean number of, not necessarily distance.
Well, the ability to swim fast and therefore utilise MCT4 is determined mainly by how much glycogen you have in those white fibres. The liver has a slow release into the arterial system, and it's really the glycogen you have stored in the muscles at the beginning of a training set that is dictates how much work you can do at the high, the various level you want to work at. And there is a very important paper in my reckoning of what's happening that was put out in 1989, Freund et al. And showed that with 10-second bursts at 200% max, 200% max in swimming is 50 metre pace. Right? He showed that the glycogen in the white fibres was completely depleted in 8 minutes' work. Right? And that's dictated most of my input of the MCT4 training, but at 50 pace, it's 6 to 8 minutes work, right? So we're looking, when we're doing 100 metre pace swimming, as long as We've been, as we've protected those glycogen sources in the 2 days prior to a set, we can get 600 to 800 metres swimming. And so the glycogen is that main source of the petrol, and you run out, you're done. So the main thing that we're doing with our controls of sets is that we're making sure that we don't get into that glycogen when we're doing most of our work. 70% of your work is done using fat metabolism, and so you're just protecting that, and then you're doing major sets at high speed regularly enough, and twice a week is the kind of norm if you're doing major sets of white fibre work, and you just set it up so that it happens, right? And then when you can set it up so that it happens, you then are wanting to maximise the turnover of your taxis so that they get under stress. And
that's when that adaptation's taken place.
Yeah, so you want more and more of these taxis, because you have more and more of these taxis. Your efflux from the white fibres is going to be more rapid, right? And so the white fibres will continue to be able to work because they will stop working if the lactate builds up to a certain level internally. Right? But if you've got these taxis working twice as good as they were, you know, twice the number as they were at the start of the season, then those white fibres at that force level can last twice as long. Right?
Let's talk a little bit about taper. Mm-hmm. What's going on at taper, where the workload is reduced? Mm-hmm. Is the adaptation still going on, or are you just basically kind of holding on?
Yeah. Well, there are two, in my book, there are two kinds of major adaptations. There are adaptations like these taxis I'm talking about. They look as though when they're stressed, they probably build overnight. So they're kind of, you got this kind of transition in the body on an almost daily basis when you kind of work them hard. But when you have a high level of activity with your mitochondria, when the MCT1s are very active, you're doing high heart rate work, and you do this for about 3 weeks, right? Very intense high heart rate work. Then the mitochondria decide that, hey, we need to have more, right? And we know this, you know, the people that have done muscle biopsies at the start of a season and at the end of a season, we know the mitochondria number has increased dramatically over that period of time, over a 10-week period. Right, but what's not well known, but it's something that I've used for about 25 years, is that this increase of the mitochondria is not overnight. It appears to happen about every 2 weeks, 3 weeks with these people, and you get a dramatic change in the aerobic ability of the athlete, which extends over a 10-day period, and I have recognised this as a mitochondrial split, because if you look at the literature, the mitochondria increase in number by splitting into halves, right?
And that's basically a new taxi, a new bus.
It's a new garage, right? The mitochondria is a garage, right?
That's garage for our Americans who don't know what garage.
Garages where they take in the oxygen and take in the glycogen and spit out the lactate or use the lactate. These mitochondria are
just little energy factories.
That's what they are. Right? And these increase in number. And so what I've seen over the years, because I've taken very precise measures of heart rate and speed, is that, and mainly with the distance people, but I work with a lot of sprinters as well, is that this, after 3 weeks' work, of solid work, suddenly the heart rate goes very, very high. And so the curve that I draw, with 3 or 5 200s, suddenly goes to the left. That is, it looks as though your efficiency is dramatically dropped, and the athletes will suddenly go from repeat 58s to repeat 60s or 61s. Right? When this has happened, you have lost that ability for about 10 days, and that's pretty well what happens. For 10 days, you're swimming the same sets but very, very slow. And the other, that's one of the main adaptations, right? It's the one that occurs most frequently. And another adaptation, because these white fibres do become red fast twitch fibres, right? And you can't have that happening every day, every time you do a set, right? But so after many, many fast sets, you get these significant changes where you've lost speed for quite some time, and it's around about 3 weeks. And when this happens, what I think is happening is you've got this huge change in this muscle from the white variety to the red fast twitch variety. So there's a whole lot. There's a plumbing system called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's significantly different in the red fast twitch fibres than it is in the whites. And the reds, naturally enough, have got capillary network around them, and the whites haven't. So for that transition to occur, there's very significant changes going on, and that's the 3 week period. And this seems to happen just like the mitochondria at one particular point in their training. You do a lot of fast training, then bang, all of a sudden you go into these transitions. This has often worried me because, you know, I've had to make these assumptions that these things have happened in my model. Right? But recently in the literature, they are starting to talk of transcriptors, that when you do some hard work, there's a little messenger that's left around the muscle grouping called a transcriptor. And when these build up to a certain level, they then say, ha-ha, it's time to do something about this. And you get these huge kind of changes, which I call adaptations, that in the body. And so when you're tapering, you have to take account of this. You don't want those things to happen, right? And so it's been my recommendation to the Australians and now to the British coaches, the ones that I work with, not all of them comply to the recipes of life. You have a five. I recommend a 5 week taper for the fast work, right? down to a certain level. So if you're working at 800 metres a set, right, this will come down to 100 for the sprinters or 200 for the 200 people in the last week, right? And for the mitochondrial changes, that kind of work, which is a high heart rate work, a 3 week taper where we bring them down to 1,000 metres in the last week.
So just to quickly summarise, there's two levels of adaptation going on during the training periods. Two major levels. And one of those levels is the production of mitochondria. And then the second adaptation is the production or morphing of the white fibers producing offspring, which are red fast twitch fibers at this point in time. And you're kind of trying to create a model of when those adaptations happen, how you stress those systems to allow the swimmer to continue to train, and then have those systems adaptate by increasing whether it's mitochondria or the number of fast twitch fibers. And it all comes down to the cycles of training, and everyone's trying to predict what those cycles are. But you're kind of seeing that there's a 10-day period where the athlete goes into a funk and he's just, or she's not performing very well. And then when they come out of that, that adaptation occurs, and they're at pretty much a level higher than they were prior to. I guess when you look at taper, you know, that probably would explain why a lot of people just don't feel really well during the taper, but it's just because that adaptation is happening, and you just have to be patient through that. Is that a safe summary?
Yeah, pretty well. Quite frequently I say to a coach, hey, this is a good time. You know, we're 4 weeks out or we're 3 weeks out, and there's been a significant shift in the heart rate curve backwards. That is, you know, if they've been swimming 62s at 180 beats per 62s at around about 160 beats per minute, and then suddenly they're swimming 62s at 180 beats per minute, right? Then this is an adaptation that's going on, and if we're 3 weeks out or we're 2 weeks out, we know they're going to feel pretty rotten for a 10-day period. But if we've got 10 days before the meet starts, hey, this is good, right? And quite frequently the coach would ask me to, people like Laurie Lawrence in Australia would say, get them out and you say that to them, right? You say that to them. Right? And so we've brought a lot of athletes through this kind of situation, you know, knowing that the feeling they have is the best feeling, because a rotten feeling means in 10 days' time they're going to be very good.
Well, this has been an absolutely informing interview, and I think a lot of our listeners will learn a lot from this. And, you know, Bob, it's great having your expertise here and sharing this with our audience for Swimming World Radio.
Yeah, thank you, Brent. It's been a pleasure.